How to survive the fall of Constantinople. Let's say you want to read some of Johannes Gutenberg's first printed words as they come off the press. You want to watch the ink dry on some of the first sentences produced by a technology that democratized knowledge, inspired an unprecedented surge in literacy, pushed Europe into the modern age, and didn't invent a new means of communication so much as invent mass communication. So you travel back to the year 1453, to the town of Mainz, Germany, and you search for Gutenberg and his press. When I ask Cornelia Schneider, curator of the Gutenberg Museum, where to look, she tells me you can find his workshop in a big house called Hof zum Humbrecht, which is just a few blocks north of the Mainz Cathedral along the banks of the Rhine. There, you'll observe Gutenberg invent a printing technique that remained the standard for almost 500 years. Watch as he carefully sets two pages of Gothic printed letters over the course of 6 hours, smacks them with ink, and then presses the letters against paper until his entire contraption creaks under the strain. If you pick up one of the sheets, you can settle into a corner and read one of the first ink-stamped pages. You may at first be a little surprised at what you see, because you won't be reading a page from the famous Gutenberg Bible. His Bible is his most renowned work, and for good reason. The 180 copies he printed using his efficient press revolutionized communication by dramatically cutting the cost of producing books, leading to a democratization of both their knowledge and even literacy itself. But before he could print the Bible, Gutenberg needed to test his device, and he needed to raise money, explains Eric White, curator of rare books for the Princeton University Library and author of Edidio Princeps, A History of the Gutenberg Bible. To do so, Gutenberg printed a variety of smaller contract jobs. He printed a German poem, a few Latin grammar books, but he also printed a plea written by the Catholic Church. So if you visit Gutenberg's printing press in 1453 and read one of the first documents ever printed, you'll read an ad. It's a call for a crusade. The ad was an effort by the Catholic Church to raise money and recruit soldiers for a new offensive against the Sultan Mehmed II and his expanding Ottoman Empire. The 21-year-old Mehmed II had been Sultan for only 2 years, but he had already marshaled his forces to Constantinople's doorstep. Without the eastern capital of Christianity serving as a bulwark, the Church feared the Islamic onslaught would continue all the way to Western Europe, so they fell back on a centuries-old strategy to stem it. They tried to raise a crusade. It didn't work. According to White, the world's first print advertising campaign failed spectacularly. By the 15th century, European citizenry had lost their crusading appetite. Enthusiasm for starvation marches to engage in combat with edged weaponry had long since dimmed. But even when the Church merely asked for funds rather than lives, it found a cynical audience. For too many years, the Vatican had used the specter of an Islamic onslaught to raise money for foreign fights and then used it to line local pockets. As Pope Pius II later lamented, "People think our sole object is to amass gold. No one believes what we say. Like insolvent tradesmen, we are without credit." For Gutenberg, the medium was a resounding success, but his first message a spectacular failure. Almost no European money or soldiers ever went to the aid of Constantinople as it prepared for its existential battle against the Ottoman Empire. But you're not as jaded as the medieval European public, so let's say you buy the pitch and you go to the defense of the city. You sail down the Italian coast, through the Mediterranean, past Greece, into the Aegean Sea, then the Sea of Marmara, up the Bosphorus Strait, into the Golden Horn, and in the spring of 1453, you arrive at the capital of the Byzantine Empire. You're sailing into a slaughter. Outside the city, 80,000 soldiers of the Ottoman Empire prepare for siege. Leading the army is the Sultan Mehmed II, whose ambition is only matched in size by a nose so large and crooked that one portrait artist later described it as on point of touching his lips. When his father, Murad, died, Mehmed ordered his baby brother drowned to clear up any issues of successorship. Footnote: Mehmed II believed so fervently in fratricide that he not only formalized the practice into law, but recommended that whichever of his many sons became sultan should kill the rest of Mehmed's own children in the interest of the world order. His son Bayezid gruesomely took his advice and ordered 19 of his siblings strangled in a single night. Some historians also believe that Bayezid poisoned Mehmed himself, who died of a sudden illness at age 49. Then he mobilized his empire to take Constantinople. All his life, he later said, he dreamed of making the city the capital of the Ottoman Empire and fulfilling the prophecy Muhammad himself had set forth when he said, "One day Constantinople will be conquered. Great is the commander who conquers it. Great are his soldiers." In the 2 years since he became Sultan, Mehmed marshaled the vast resources of the Ottoman Empire toward his goal. He constructed an entire castle, the Bozkesen, literally throat slitter, at the narrowest point of the Bosphorus Strait for the sole purpose of blocking aid to Constantinople. Then he hired a Hungarian specialist to build him the world's greatest cannon, known as the Basilic. It was not only the largest artillery piece at the time, it is one of the biggest cannons ever constructed. Cast entirely in bronze and measuring 24 feet long, it could fire a 600-pound cannonball over a mile. Yet it wasn't the most practical device. The barrel required 3 hours to cool before it could be fired again, and at 35,000 pounds it was so heavy it required 60 oxen and 400 men to move. But Mehmed II's preparations hardly stopped at artillery. He constructed at least 60 ships, hired mercenaries, and trained an army of at least 80,000 soldiers. On April 6, 1453, he gathered his cannons, ships, and soldiers at the walls of Constantinople. But what walls they were! Constantinople, called Istanbul today, is a natural fortress. The city sits on the point of a peninsula jutting into the Sea of Marmara, poking out into the confluence of the Golden Horn Inlet that runs along the city's north edge and the Bosphorus Strait to its east. Deep water envelops the city on three sides, and along this entire sea-facing frontage rose stone walls 15 to 30 feet high. On the fourth side, along the city's land-exposed western flank, rose the great Theodosian walls. Built by Emperor Theodosius II in 413, they formed the most formidable defensive structure in Europe. The Theodosian barricade was not a singular wall, but instead a series of three. The first wall was a 6-foot-high sheer stone barrier, which stood behind a 60-foot-wide, 30-foot-deep moat. Behind the small wall towered a 30-foot-high, 15-foot-thick outer wall, and behind that loomed a 65-foot-tall interior wall, which was anchored on both ends with fortresses and interspersed with no fewer than 96 regularly spaced 30-foot-high towers. Emperor Theodosius built this ridiculously imposing defensive structure because the city's pivotal location along land and sea trading routes, as well as its natural deep seaport, had inspired envy and attack for more than 1,000 years. Mehmed II was not the first emperor to covet Constantinople's throne, nor the first Ottoman sultan, nor even the first in his family. In 1422, his father had sieged the city for 3 months, assailed the walls with 10,000 soldiers, and failed. The Slavs attacked and failed in 540, 559, and again in 581. In 626, 12,000 Constantinople defenders defeated an army of 80,000 Persian and Avar soldiers, and from 669 to 679, Arab attackers led a near-sustained siege on the city. That too failed. Constantinople's massive fortifications enabled the city to survive nearly every attack, save for an assault by Christian crusaders in 1204, who sieged and sacked the city before the Byzantines regained control. But even the tallest walls required defenders, and by the time you sail into Constantinople, the Byzantine Empire will have long passed its former glory. At their height, more than a millennium ago, the Byzantines, who called themselves the Eastern Roman Empire, conquered the Mediterranean. Their territory stretched from present-day Spain to Jerusalem to northern Africa. You'll see the former wealth and opulence of their empire in the magnificent buildings, art, and libraries around the city. These buildings include the Hagia Sophia, built in the 6th century, which at 180 feet tall, stood for a time as the tallest building in the world. You'll see the Great Hippodrome, the arena built in the 3rd century to host the city's giant chariot races. It seats as many as 100,000 spectators, more than twice that of Rome's Colosseum. The Byzantine Empire was once the most powerful in the region, and perhaps the world, but a millennium of famine, plague, and the rising Ottoman Empire whittled it down to a fraction of its former glory. By the time you arrive, the empire that had once conquered the Mediterranean will barely control its own peninsula. Where once the empire could draw upon resources from across three continents to defend itself, when Mehmed and 80,000 soldiers march into view of the parapets, the city can muster only a mere 7,000 to its defense. 7,001, counting you. Join that defense, but do so wisely. The sea walls, which stand between 15 and 30 feet tall and surround the city's ocean frontage, see the least combat and thus are the safest assignment. Unfortunately, it's more likely you'll be posted on the Theodosian walls themselves, where the Ottomans focus their attack. Even so, some sections of this wall will be more dangerous than others. If you can, avoid a deployment in the middle section, called the Mesa Tahian. It's where the Lycus River runs, where the walls are weakest, and thus where Mehmed concentrates his assault. Try to guard the northern or southern edges of the wall instead. From there, you'll watch as the Ottoman army establishes its camps, sails its ships into the Bosphorus Strait, and marshals its massive artillery into position. On April 6, 1453, you'll see a large puff of smoke rise from the Basilic cannon. You'll hear a mighty distant boom and feel the parapet shudder from the impact of its 600-pound stone ball. The Theodosian walls weren't built with cannons in mind, so when the 600-pound rock balls slam into the barriers, the stones crumble and shatter. Nevertheless, the outer wall is more than 30 feet thick. Some of the shots bring down sections, but you and the rest of the defenders can scurry down at night and in between volleys fill the gaps with wood, dirt, and pieces of shattered stone before any Ottoman force can organize an attack. With continuous repair, the walls hold. On April 12th, after 6 days of relentless bombardment, the Ottomans launch their first frontal assault. The battle may at first feel definitive, but Mehmed is merely probing. At this early stage, he's not yet committed to sending the weight of his full army. Instead, he's testing the will and defensive tactics of the city and its lead defender, a Genoese warrior and part-time pirate named Giovanni Giustiniani. Don't worry, it's a test the city easily passes. The Ottomans concentrate this assault in the gaps formed in the partially shattered sections of the wall, but in those narrow paths, their numerical advantage means nothing. Ground troops fight their frontal lines to a standstill, while you and the rest of the defenders atop the wall can assail the invaders with arrows, rocks, bullets from handheld cannons called culverins, spears, and boiling oil. Some attackers attempt to climb the walls with ladders and grappling hooks, but you can chop the ropes, push away the ladders, and engage the unfortunate few that arrive on top. After 4 hours of fighting, the Ottomans suffer heavy casualties while inflicting few and retreat. With any luck, if you remain on top of the interior wall, you should be safe. His land attack foiled, Mehmed tries again, this time by sea. As it has done for centuries in its defense, the city will extend a massive chain across the mouth of the Golden Horn Inlet to prevent attacking ships from surrounding the city's coastline, then will defend the chain with its navy. Though Mehmed's ships outnumber Constantinople's, the city's navy is the superior one, and in the first sea battle, the Ottomans suffer another severe defeat. On April 20th, 4 European ships even managed to slip past the Ottoman blockade and provide the city with much-needed aid. But in a move of tactical genius, Mehmed rolls his naval fleet over land on oiled logs, circumventing Giovanni's blockade. Don't take part in these sea battles if you can avoid it. And if you can't, don't be captured. The Ottomans gruesomely torture and execute all 60 sailors they take prisoner. In response, the Byzantines march all 260 of their Ottoman captives to the top of the wall and behead them. The loss of control over the Golden Horn is a blow to the Constantinople defense, but not a mortal one. Over the next month, every Ottoman tactic and assault ends in disaster. On May 7th, they again assault the walls, this time by filling in the moat with dirt and debris and rolling giant wooden towers to the wall. But this seemingly ingenious plan will end disastrously when soldiers from Constantinople slip out at night with sacks of black powder and detonate the massive structures. If you need to prove your bravery after your sea battle dereliction, you can join this group. They make it home. After Mehmed's plan to go over the top of the walls fails, he orders his army to go below. His miners dig tunnels beneath the walls, seeking both to destabilize them from underneath and to sneak soldiers behind their lines. But this attack fares even worse than the towers. Constantinople counters with its own tunnels. They intercept the unfortunate miners they encounter and torture them for the locations of the other tunnels. When they find them, they fill them with fire and smoke. By May 25th, after a month and a half of successful defense, you may begin to feel like you might survive. You might believe that the city will once again hold. Even Mehmet himself apparently has doubts because he offers a deal. He guarantees the lives and possessions of every citizen of Constantinople if Emperor Palaiologos surrenders the city. But Palaiologos declines, and Mehmet decides his only option is to pursue a final all-out assault. Spies in the Turkish camp report Mehmet's decision back to Constantinople, and both sides prepare for the deciding battle. The Ottoman army spends Saturday, May 28th, resting and praying, while in Constantinople the city fills the Hagia Sophia for an enormous ceremony. You'll have very little time left in Constantinople, but when Mehmet rests his army, it gives you a few free hours. You need to spend them wisely. You need to salvage Constantinople's most valuable possessions. You need to save its books. The 1,000-year-old Imperial Library of Constantinople was at one time one of the best-stocked libraries in the world, housing more than 100,000 manuscripts from the ancient Greek philosophers, many of which were the world's only copy. These books were more than just intellectual curiosities or valuable artifacts. In a medieval Europe that had long forgotten the knowledge of the ancient Greeks, these timeless works contained the revolutionary philosophies that would provide the catalyst for the Renaissance. The word Renaissance comes from the French word for rebirth, because the intellectual movement was sparked not by new ideas, but the rediscovery of very old ones. As Constantinople stood on the verge of collapse, Europe hungered for the ideas and discoveries of the ancient Greeks and Romans. This interest began more than a century earlier, when the Italian poet Petrarch, considered the father of the Renaissance, found a series of long-forgotten letters between the ancient Roman statesman Cicero and his childhood friend Atticus discussing the ideas of the ancient Greek philosophers. These letters set off a movement among medieval scholars to rediscover the books of the ancient Greek and Roman philosophers. They dragged Europe out of what Petrarch called his era's Dark Ages and sparked the greatest intellectual revolution in Europe's history. The books of the ancient Greeks sitting in Constantinople and moldering away in European monasteries contained philosophies and scientific discoveries of almost unimaginable genius, far more advanced than those of Europe's scientists living more than 1,000 years later. They included the theories of scholars like Democritus, who in 400 BCE came to the remarkable conclusion that humans, the earth, the sky, and everything else in the universe were composed of tiny individual particles that combined to form an infinite arrangement of complex structures. He called these particles atoms. The books contained the even more radical ideas of the ancient Greek philosopher Epicurus, who built on Democritus's ideas and reasoned that if the universe was built upon atoms and void, then humans occupied no more special a place in the universe than any other creature or matter. If there was no hierarchy of material, he argued, then humans, the stars, and the sun could not be supreme celestial beings. Instead, they were simply transitory collisions of atoms, born from nothing and destined for the void. But rather than spark an existential crisis, Epicurus believed this knowledge to be wonderfully freeing. It freed him from the burden of pleasing the gods or sacrificing for them in some hopeless attempt to win their favor. It freed him to seek that which made him happy, to pursue scientific discovery, and to avoid pain and suffering. If there was nothing to be gained from pain, suffering served no purpose. In a medieval era dominated by church orthodoxy that considered pleasure-seeking behavior a sin, suffering a path to salvation, and discouraged scientific inquiry that pried into God's secrets, Epicurus's ideas were profound, controversial, and infectious. They sparked a philosophical movement called humanism, which became the driving philosophy behind the Renaissance. Humanism radically realigned European philosophy and science by placing agency on the self rather than in the divine or supernatural. Humanists were not necessarily atheists. In fact, most of them were devout Roman Catholics, but they centered the pursuit of happiness, sought rational explanations for earthly problems, and shifted their focus to humans rather than the divine. Famous humanists include many of the Renaissance's most celebrated philosophers and thinkers, including Giordano Bruno, later burned at the stake, Niccolo Machiavelli, and Leonardo da Vinci. At the same time that Western European interest in the works of the ancient Greeks began to grow, refugees fleeing Constantinople brought the means to fertilize them. They carried books and the language to read them. Among these refugees was the scholar John Argyropoulos, who survived the sack of Constantinople and escaped to Florence, where he went on to translate numerous ancient Greek texts and teach classical Greek to students, including Leonardo da Vinci, before he died in Rome in 1487, supposedly from overconsumption of watermelon. You need to help him. You can join the refugees in Italy who dump fuel on the sparks of Western Europe's humanist movement and help drive profound revolutions in science, politics, and art that reverberate to the modern day. You just need to save a few books first. You can find the library near the entrance to the palace. When you make your way inside, look for works that scholars know existed but have never been found, such as most of the books of Diogenes. Homer's first poem, Aristarchus of Samos, and his wild theory that the earth and planets orbit the sun, along with most of the writings of Aristotle. You have until midnight. In the early morning hours of May 29th, the first wave of Ottoman soldiers crashes against the Constantinople defense, which means you'll need to leave the library and return to the wall to avoid a dangerous charge of dereliction. Under the cover of dark, Mehmed sends out his first soldiers, the Bashi Bazouk. These are his mercenaries, Slavs, Hungarians, Germans, Italians, and even a few Greeks, fighting for pay and the promise of booty. They probe the length of the walls, even testing some of the sea walls, but these forays are merely distractions. Their main aim, and what Mehmed believes is his best chance, are the weak walls above the Lycus River. For 2 hours, they throw themselves against the wall, and for 2 hours, they fail. They fight wildly and without discipline or organization. When they finally draw back, they leave behind thousands. Mehmed is undeterred. The Bashi Bazouk were his weakest soldiers and his most expendable. Their goal was merely to tire. Before the sun even rises, Mehmed sends his second wave, the Anatolians. The Anatolians are devout Muslims with better weaponry, better training, and motivated by far more than money. Unlike the mercenaries, they maintain their organization, successfully climb the walls with their ladders and grappling hooks, and bring the fight to the top. You may have to resort to hand-to-hand weaponry, including the dangerous blast of a culverin, to save yourself. In the midst of this second wave, a cannonball smashes a hole in the outer wall, and the Anatolians rush through the gap. It may feel as if the end is near, but again, the Byzantine defenders not only fight off the Anatolians on the parapets, they surround and repel the attackers. They beat back the Anatolians, push them through the hole in the wall, and you and the rest of the defenders can shore up the yawning gap. By now, the fighting will have raged for 4 consecutive hours, and the Anatolians will have inflicted heavy casualties. You and the rest of the city's defense will be exhausted. Nevertheless, you will have again successfully repelled the Ottoman attack. Twice the Ottomans will have charged, and twice retreated with far fewer than they came with. You might think that yet again another empire has fatally bashed itself against the insurmountable Theodosian walls. Then Mehmed sends in his third and final wave. At 4 a.m., still hours before the sun rises on the gruesome scene, Mehmed's Janissary troops march toward the wall. The Janissaries are the finest soldiers in the Ottoman army, the most disciplined and best trained. They are Mehmed's last hope. For a third time, the Ottomans climb the walls on ladder and rope and fight along the parapets. Reload your culverin, because once again the fighting will become personal, nasty, and face-to-face. But even though the Janissaries are more skilled, coordinated, and committed, the defense holds. Their attacks begin to falter, and as the sun rises, you may again feel a glimmer of hope. Unfortunately, in the first light of day, a series of disasters will take place. First, someone on the Byzantine defense has forgotten to seal a small port door in the wall called the Kirkaporta, which was used during the battle to sneak out and mount surprise attacks directly onto the enemy. Janissary soldiers notice the mistake and rush through, and at 6 a.m., a Janissary bullet strikes Giovanni Giustiniani, the commander of the defense. When Giovanni's men remove him from the battlefield, morale collapses. The defenders rush back into the city to try to save their lives and their families, and the tide of the battle turns decisively. The Janissaries open the St. Romanus Gate from the inside and put Constantinople to the sack. Emperor Palaiologos is last seen charging into the oncoming wave. According to one account, blood flows in the Constantinople streets like rainwater in the gutters after a sudden storm. You need to move quickly. If you're caught on the city streets, you'll be tortured, killed, or enslaved. Fortunately, the attackers will be momentarily motivated by treasure, and their greed provides two options for escape. The first leaves out of the city port, where a few ships successfully escape the unguarded mouth of the inlet. By mid-morning, however, the Ottomans shut down the port for good. These early boats provide your best means for escape, but if you miss them, there is one final option. You can try to fight your way out. In the three towers nearest the entrance to the Golden Horn, a remarkable group of tenacious Cretan warriors will refuse to run. They'll barricade themselves in the towers and use shield and spear to form a deadly blockade in the narrow stairways, clogging the corridors with the bodies of the Ottoman soldiers. The Cretans will successfully fend off the Ottoman attackers for more than 8 hours, inflicting such heavy losses that the Ottomans will strike a truce. In exchange for their surrender, they'll allow the Cretans safe passage out of the city. Join up with these Cretan soldiers, pick up a shield and spear, and if you can survive the 8-hour battle, which by now will mean 15 consecutive hours of hand-to-hand combat, then late in the afternoon, you can board the last ships to leave the city. The journey back to Europe may be long and arduous, and you'll arrive on a continent panicked by Constantinople's fall, but you'll also arrive to a culture with a burgeoning interest in science, the arts, philosophy, and an appreciation for the ancient books you, hopefully, carry. Just don't read them within earshot of the Vatican, and maybe don't read any more ads, even if they are printed.